Welcome to the Beekeeper's Corner Podcast.
February 3rd, 2026, episode 292, Double Stranded. Hello, everyone. Welcome into the corner. Beekeeper's Corner. I'm Kevin England. This episode is, shall I say, unusual in a number of ways. It's a midweek release of a show, and it comes on the heels of episode 291, and if you listen to that show, then you have a primer on the backstory of why this one is following it. I have to share in this opening that I drove somewhere today and took the draft recording and played it in my car. What was my takeaway? At the end, it was a bit like Frankenstein's monster. When I was done, I thought, what have I done? This whole episode is dedicated to a product release for beekeepers in the arena of Varroa mite control. To talk about a new product coming to the marketplace should be a few minute affair. And what struck me after listening to the draft recording was, one, I sure found a lot to say. Two, holy cow, was this long and complex. And three, I think there's so much left out there when it comes to questions for this product. Which, in case you're not in the know, is Greenlight Biosciences Naroa. When I first started reviewing the product, I thought, heck, as products go, from a beekeeper, like barrier to entry, application and use profile seems to be as simple as it gets. And it still is, right? If you're going to go plunk your money down and put this in a hive, it's easy peasy. But yet, somehow, the more I looked into the backstory, the deeper I got, the more curiosities I found. I was like a dog without a bone, trying to unearth the mysteries. And even by my own admission, after listening back, I probably overdid it. But not because I wasted my time. And hopefully not yours. It was a matter of due diligence. And actually, the more I looked, the more interesting I found the topic. I wasn't content with the just buy this and see how it goes, or to repeat the company line on how you're going to use it. And because, you know, I'm a how and a why guy. I want to know how it works. I want to know why they made the choices they did in giving us the instructions and the product design. It's just how I'm wired, my nature. So this opening, I am positive, just like the episode itself, either confuses you or it gets you curious. And I'll be interested to see where people land after I hear what they have to say when they listen to it through. If anything, I'm positive my conversations with the representatives of Greenlight Biosciences to get some answers is going to be quite interesting. And I want to be clear, I don't mean any of this in a negative way. I think they did a fantastic job from what I could see. I just have questions. This product has a potential to be a cosmic shift for beekeeping. Brings us into a new chapter for things we are going to put in with our bees. It's interesting times, and I only hope that when you're done with the show, you feel the juice was worth the squeeze. What I did, how I presented it, might not be everyone's cup of tea, but what a ride. Here's the first foray into exploring Naroa, beekeeping's first double-stranded DNA product in the marketplace. For the topic of this episode, the feature name I will give it is Naroa Time. You know, it seems in the past handful of episodes I've covered some new treatment options in the form of Varroxan and Apibioxal RTU. But if you're in the know, you knew that there's a third one coming. Well, actually, I say coming. It's here for a lot of us. It's a novel, new mite treatment by the brand name of Naroa, emerging into the marketplace after its September 2025 approval by the US EPA. This product is truly unique in the way that it works. even though it's classified like other products in the marketplace as a miticide. The active ingredient in Noroa is Vatiscana, a double-stranded RNA molecule that uses RNA interference to silence a specific Varroa gene required for mite reproduction. Now, as it turns out, the product was classified as a miticide because it's technically designed to kill, or said differently, suppress Varroa mites. It's registered under the Federal Insecticide, Fungicide, and Rodenticide, that's how you say that word, also known as FIFRA, as a pesticide. And because its target organism is a mite and not a pathogen, legally and commercially, it nets out to be a miticide. Now, in a traditional sense, this is the novel aspect, unlike other miticides that kill mites through neurotoxicity, metabolic disruption, fumigation, or contact action, this one's not a miticide in the classic way. It works by silencing a specific Varroa gene that renders the female foundress mite unable to reproduce. And she doesn't die outright from exposure to contact with the active ingredient. In fact, she can live as she always would. The result of contact is not death, but a change in that, as said, she cannot produce offspring. So to repeat that, because it's novel, it doesn't poison the mite. It's not a neurotoxin, it doesn't kill on contact, and it's not a fumigant. Instead, it's a biochemical miticide that works by preventing reproduction. Now, as of today, this product is sold currently through, exclusively through Man Lake in the United States. I'm not sure if this is a forever arrangement or some contract that will eventually expire, but from what I could see, if you're in the United States and you want Noroa, you must order it from Man Lake. Visiting their website, the first thing to take note of on the product page, after you have absorbed some of the information and price, is availability. This product's not approved in every state of the United States as of this recording. Now, Man Lake does a good job at passing along which states have given the nod for purchase. I put that up front, so if you go to buy it, after hearing this, you don't get too excited only to be disappointed in finding that you can't order it yet because your state's not on board. Now, with that out of the way, let's elaborate how the product's intended to be used, how it's packaged, and along the way, we're going to delve into the characteristics, usage, and other pertinent information, and there's a lot to unpack. Now, the first thing to know is the product form factor is a pouch of liquid. In usage, you'll lay the product pouch over the top frames of the box you are treating. Locate the red tab on the packaging and pull back the label, which is a sticker affixed to the surface of the plastic pouch. Upon doing this, you're exposing prepared pores in the plastic pouch, which will let the liquid inside exude on the surface of the plastic and subsequently be consumed by the bees. In addition to removing the sticker, it is recommended that you give the pouch a gentle little squeeze to aid in the liquid coming out. It should be clear, you're not looking to squeeze the liquid out like you're wringing it out. You just want to get the flow started so there's liquid on the surface that attracts the bees to come and consume it. I know as description goes, that's a bit odd, but it can be visualized in another manner if you happen to have ever used pierced zip-top bags. And a little sidebar for you. Sometimes beekeepers use, to deliver sugar solutions, the weeping effect of liquids with zip-top bags. You fill a zip-top bag, lay it on the frame, poke some holes in it with a very sharp razor blade, something like an X-Acto knife, and it weeps. The water tension keeps it from flowing out all over the place, and the bees come and take down a constant supply of weeping liquid until it's empty. Now look, if this still seems foreign, as to how it actually works. I would suggest you visit the Manlink website and review their product page. There you will find, at minimum, two videos that demonstrate how to use and apply the product, and in one of them, the process I just attempted to describe is clearly visualized in the video. You can see how it works. Now, as with any product that you're going to put into a beehive, you should become intimately familiar with the instructions for usage. And one of the more important instructions is that you use this when honey supers are off. No honey supers. I paused for a moment so you can think about that and make your connection like you always do. But it's different. It's not necessarily because the product is harmful in any way should it come into contact with honey. It more has to do with the strategic application of the product active ingredient in relation to contact with the varroa mites. Now, it's my general understanding that worker bees take in that liquid. They also take in the active ingredient, Vatiscana, which they then place into the cells as brood food for larvae in development. And this is rather interesting by my way of thinking. The mites come into contact with the Noroa product when they enter into the cell with the larvae to be kept. In this manner, it's a bit like a trap. Mites mull around in the cell, come into contact with the brood food, and unknowingly get exposed to the active ingredient that spells the downfall of them being able to produce offspring. It's time for a Kevin moment. I wanted to disclose to you that I wanted to produce this segment quite some time ago. I did a lot of research, but it just kept leading me down different pathways. It took me quite a bit of time to dig around to find the details about how they come into contact, and to clear up some other possible misconceptions, which I think I have right, but again, I'm not 100% sure. Now, what I said aligns with what I learned, but I said general understanding in my conveyance of it. Those are the words I used. The thing that held me up and stopped me from putting this out earlier is related to the mite contact with the active ingredient. If you read the research papers that have been posted, and there are several on Greenlight Biosciences' website, they all infer that everything happens in the cell, within the realm of bees in development. And specifically what I was trying to figure out and dig on is what they didn't say, or I didn't find. It's that adult bees ingest the ingredient, and when mites feed on the adults, it's passed through the hemolymph or fat bodies of the adults as they're feeding on them. Nor did I find it anywhere stated that mites get the active ingredient by feeding on the larva during development. No, it's not there. Haven't found it. It seems to infer, or this is just what I ended up finding, that they simply have to come in contact with it in the form of brood food, and mere contact is how it's transmitted to the mites. And to bolster that, there's a single sentence in the research paper provided by Greenlight Biosciences that takes you down a rabbit hole. It says they learned that they could impact varroa mites by, quote, direct injection of the mites, end quote. And if you read right past that, you would skip through it and not maybe get what's there. But because I was looking so hard to find it, I followed that out. That statement had a reference to it. Direct injection of the mites. And it cites work done by the Department of Laboratory Animal Sciences, Nanchang University, in collaboration with researchers in the U.S. from Michigan. The link takes you to a reference piece of research entitled Genes Important for Survival or Reproduction in Varroa Destruction Identified by RNAi. I'm sorry, I'm going to do this. Wait, I think this is a first, a sub moment in a Kevin moment. And Michigan, but like who did the work, deserves a footnote. The main name on that research paper that I just cited, Genes Important for Survival, blah, 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 is Zachary Y. Wong. That guy. Seriously, that guy. I cannot tell you how many times I've come across his name in the years of looking at pivotal beekeeping research papers. It's sad. Every beekeeper should know, be given a primer on how much instrumental work that guy has done for the foundation of beekeeping science. And yet, I bet only the beekeepers in the Michigan region likely know the name on the reference. Seeley? Tom Seeley. Household name. Wong? Probably never heard of him. And he has such an impressive body of work. Astonishing. In my mind, his bust would be on the Mount Rushmore of beekeeping research if I had my way. And out of deep respect, I know I'm off on a tangent, a sub-Kevin moment. I had to stop and put that in here. So end of the sub-moment. Coming back to center, when you read the paper, Nanchang, Michigan paper, the one that tells you that you can target Varroa mites by injecting them with dsRNA materials, it opens up another can of worms. It seems to me in my naive connection of how this new product was designed to work that Greenlight Biosciences figured out how to deliver the specific payload through feeding simply so the bees could come into contact with it, which leads you into the in the cell feeding thing. But the research paper I'm currently talking about, Nanchang, Michigan, infers that there are a number of possible gene manipulation targets to shutting down Varroa reproduction, and the reason they know that is they injected the mites directly. They physically injected them to make the contact. Now, if you think about that, just looking at the Nanchang, Michigan thing, the implications are quite profound, as there could be more opportunity to go after Varroa mites using other methods of turning genes and doing things like that off. I suppose this could be a topic for another day, as I feel like I'm deep down in the Alice in Wonderland type hole. But I have to say it out loud that if this has whet your curiosity about other pathways beyond suppressing mite repopulation, look in the show notes for a link to that research paper. Well, after you've read it, you can personally go down your own rabbit hole of the art of the possible for payload delivery undiscovered. All of that was to say that when they injected the mites, it had the same effect for whatever the targeted gene therapy was. It closed the loop. Injection was the pathway, and the method in the alternative research did not involve feeding bees as the payload. Never once in that paper did they say we could pass along this RNA eye interference thing by having mites feed on bees. So it seems to me that if contact works, then the real role the bees play in the Greenlight Biosciences approach is what I said a moment ago. The bees are partners in delivery. They deliver the payload through food, and now we might have a bit of a suggestion as to why sugar solution was chosen as the carrier medium in the plastic bags. If I have this right, then darn, this solution is a pretty clever design. And I have to counter that with, in all my looking, I didn't find any reference that a mite feeds on a bee, one that has taken in the double-stranded RNA, and that results in an impact of their ability to reproduce and produce offspring. Now look, I'm never prepared to say never. It's too early in the game to know all the ins and outs of this. And I will share with you that I'm planning to stop in the Noroa booth next week at the Midwest Expo, which I'm attending in Madison, Wisconsin. I'm sure they'll be there, and I'll have some open questions to see if they can set a few curiosities straight. And, you know, of course, I will pass along any clarifications as they come in future programs. Now, I knew at some point in this elaboration there's going to come a moment to speak about this new approach, dsRNA. I could go on a tangent about how double-stranded RNA process works, but that would likely put you to sleep, and honestly, I'm not sure that I'm qualified to do it in any way. Although I bet I could take a pretty respectable shot at it after all the digging I've done. What I do want to address is the elephant in the room. My favorite reference is the Jurassic Park moment, "Life will find a way." And the famous line I'm positive I have quoted in the past in this program, something akin to, "Just because we could doesn't mean we should." People really get squeamish about this gene splicing kind of science, letting it loose in nature. Upon looking into the research, there's one paper that provided where they reviewed what this might do to other non-target insects that could come into contact with the product. Seems a logical thing to check, doesn't it? More specifically, it was reviewed for insects that could meet the ingredients in the product as they are being distributed in a beehive environment. Reporting what they learned, the news is good and quite possibly great. Now, mind you, this is the company having to do research, presumably due diligence on behest of getting product approval. But what they found was interesting to read in itself. We know that things get inside of beehives. Small hive beetles, wax moths, I see earwigs and spiders, and, well, you get it, things get in. They, Greenlight Biosciences, likely had an obligation to test the product on these insects and a couple other marquee insects that you would test, you would think the world wants to know about, fruit flies and butterflies and the like. Now, sitting here today and knowing that the product is approved, you might have guessed that the end result is it's not going to cause strife around the world. That's not to say that they didn't find some things or speculate on some things. For example, it called out that monarch butterflies could possibly be impacted by this dsRNA process. How would a monarch butterfly come into contact with the liquid in the bottom of a honeybee cell? I'm not sure, but if it got out into the wild, maybe, possibly, it could damage monarch butterflies. Now, going to the extreme, if a honeybee carried the food out of the beehive and put it on a flower, then yeah, maybe you could have an unintended consequence, a collision, but it seems a bit random to even consider this. So why did they look at monarch butterflies? I'll get to that in a moment, but what I want to say is the outcome of the non-target insects were good and possibly great. Good means it's generally not an impact. Now, great is the door is open to sequestering other types of mites that are closely related to Varroa destructor. And of course, we are all familiar with Varroa destructor, which is our Varroa mite. And this product is intended to be that target, Varroa destructor. I say that and it's so patently obvious, but you may or may not be aware that there's another Varroa mite in the form of Varroa jacobsoni. If you're a beekeeper, say, in the Asia-Pac region, then you know there's another nemesis that they fight, Varroa jacobsoni. It's their equivalent of our Varroa destructor. And it seems like this product could target jacobsoni. Could target that mite too. The profile of the dsRNA working on other mites hit on two other mites beyond destructor and jacobsoni. Ones that you might have heard of recently. The Stratiolalaps mite and the Tropilalaps mite. I said great. Now, how about that for an interesting connection? Beekeepers continually ask, from what I see, that if Tropilelops makes its way to our shores, what are we going to do about it? What things might we have? Well, now maybe this one can fit in the toolbox. Now, I don't want to gloss over good, the term good that I offered, with a rubber stamp. As to testing other insects, the general consensus is good. And I'm sure we would wonder about specific things we see coming into our beehives as beekeepers. Wouldn't we want to know whether this has any impact on small hive beetles, wax moths? And yeah, there's still tracheal mites out there. The shorter answer is no impact. Now, while we would love to really whack small hive beetles and wax moths and such, the good news is this product is engineered to do Varroa Destructor, and that's all it does. Doesn't go after those other ones. No impact. On the flip side, there are some insects in the broader spectrum that showed some activity when exposed to the product. Two spotted spider mites, a strain of European earwigs, some fruit flies, black soldier flies, and as mentioned earlier, monarch butterflies could potentially be in the target. It's possible that they would all have some reaction if they would come into contact with Naroa. Now, you have to unpack that a little bit. And let's use the monarch butterfly, which is probably one of the biggest concerns for humans. The gene chosen by the research impacts the Varroa mite's calmodulin gene. Calmodulin is spelled C-A-L-M-O-D-U-L-I-N. I think I'm pronouncing it right, but maybe not. I don't know what that does. And in looking it up, I found clues to it. And in the end, I took my summary of what I learned and asked AI if I was right. And if it didn't hallucinate, this is what it said. What I found, and it agreed that I had it right. The calmodulin gene is involved in the triggering process that begins egg activation in the reproductive process. At the beginning of a mite creating the egg to deliver a new offspring, there has to be a trigger, and that's what this gene does. It inferred that if you can interrupt the activation process in some way, then in essence you stop reproduction. Now I have to say that what I'm saying is speculation based on the crumbs available in the research paper. And there's nothing that says, here's the dummy version of what this thing actually does. And I think, knowing a little bit about how pharma works, the true mechanism of action is not spelled out verbatim, because then other companies could copy it. It's usually listed as generalities because, well, likely only Greenlight Biosciences knows the exact full science and details. Now, I probably should have mentioned this earlier, but the research paper of the work done by Greenlight Biosciences entitled RNA Interference's Next Generation Control Method for Suppressing Varroa Destructor Reproduction in Honeybees. And then it has in parentheses Apis mellifera hives. In that study, I found some morsels of what this product does. And here's a snippet from the research, and to be transparent, I'm paraphrasing it some to eliminate all of the, you know, references and research jargon that's in the middle of the sentence that would be indecipherable given in an audible form. So this is the distilled version of it. Calmodulin is a highly conserved protein that regulates calcium, which plays an important role in the fertilization and development of animals. That was the first clause I picked out. Then it said, a rise in calcium known as the calcium wave is necessary for invertebrate egg activation and the initial steps of development. A disruption to these calcium regulatory processes could explain the observed effects of Vatiscana on mite reproduction. That's where it ends. The study says that the active ingredient was applied in different concentrations, and in some concentrations, a small number of mites did successfully reproduce. It seemed, however, the correlation, the higher the concentration, the less likely for a mite to break through and reproduce. It also called out a finding that they observed when testing that some of the foundress mites were discovered with a thick white mass on their undersides. They described it as resembling an egg mass. And there were pictures of varroa mites in the study, the undersides of the varroa mites with this thick white goo under them. They had a picture of a normal underside and white goo underside. So I didn't say, how does this all connect to the monarch butterfly? In the case of the monarch butterfly, a different study was cited as a reference in the middle of that paper I was just talking about, using different controls for some specific RNA strands. It said it is predicted to have the potential to effectively silence the butterfly's cow modulin gene. So in the middle of that paper, it cited a different paper that said these RNA things could possibly cross over to monarchs. Now, coming back to that research paper about the impacts to other insects, their report on that, it had this to say, quote, "These authors found no evidence of any measurable effect of the dsRNA on life history traits of monarch butterflies, even at a tenfold higher dose than proposed to be used in the treatment of honeybee hives," end quote. In plain speak, they dosed monarch butterflies with 10 times the concentration, saw no impact, if that's the way I read that. Now, all of this is interesting and potentially enlightening or confusing all at the same time. And this is where I have to point out that in the United States, the route for product approval is a curious path to observe. Talked about that in the past on this program. The application company, in this case Greenlight Biosciences, has to do a lot of science to bolster what they give to the government for the product application. They share in the burden of proof to supply impact data. And you might ask yourself, are there tons of information from other research out there, researchers, say peer reviews to the impact, to prove what Greenlight Biosciences said? Well, usually the answer is no. No, there isn't. And you might say, well, in the absence of peer review or independent research to back this up, maybe the government does it. Maybe they do the checking and the fact-finding and whatever. Not normally. It doesn't work that way. That tactic doesn't get employed. In the end, could this net out to someday be a real Jurassic Park outcome? We certainly hope not. And you have to take solace. Government experts look at the risk and only approve with an abundance of due diligence and caution. The government has the right people, by their estimation, to do the job. Things don't get through. They're on the watch. Now, don't pan me for that statement. Some will take massive issue with the expertise of the government and consider the phrase government experts as an oxymoron. To bolster that notion, I saw some really interesting comments in the research responses From citizens asking where the credible research is, everything was from Greenlight. Who's checking that? You know, I don't know that I have the energy to go down that road. I'm only going to tell you what we found. Go back to the shill comment from the previous episode. The road I will go down on is the safety profile of this product. Because sometimes that kind of tells the tale. Sometimes. And in this case, I think it's really illuminating. Whenever a solution comes out, you could turn and read the safety data sheet. In reviewing the safety profile for Noroa, I find it could not have been any more pedestrian. All safety sheets have the same warning language, protect yourself during application, and so on. This one, however, especially when you look at the instructions for contact with human beings, I think is one of the most non-event descriptions they've ever seen. I don't think they actually have ever seen one like this. It often says under anticipated conditions some threatening phrases that could serve to put you on notice, and that's its job. In this one it says, not expected to present a significant hazard. It further points out that symptoms are not expected or anticipated after inhalation, skin contact, eye contact, or ingestion. In the absence of a warning language phrase, which is customary, it simply guides responders to treat symptomatically. Also, the first aid measures are ordinary, and when you look at the product, what it contains, you could speculate that the answer as to why is in the concentrations of the ingredients. It is 62% water and 37% sugar. Do the math and that nets out to 99% of the product in the plastic bag is sugar water, with less than 1% Vatiscana. And Vatiscana does not appear risky because the safety data sheet provides instructions that say, if you ingest it, rinse your mouth out, and call poison control if you feel unwell. It doesn't say call poison control immediately, which is almost always the case. It says call if you feel unwell. Now look, I'm in no way suggesting you think this stuff is harmless. The safety data sheet still instructs you to follow proper precautions for handling. Wear protective gloves, wear protective clothing. But to gauge that on activity and exposure. It even has a clause there. That's what it says. So to me, phrasing such of that is so unusual. It calls for no special eye protection and does not require respiratory protection either. Yeah. If you know how these safety data sheets read, they often tell you to protect yourself from the most innocuous things. This has to be the most routine data sheet I think I have ever seen. Now, when it comes to these drugs, there's only one thing I keep as a curiosity. It has to do with longevity of the ingredients in the environment. Kevin Moment, how long does Ametraz persist? I've never been able to get a straight answer to that, end of Kevin Moment. The safety data sheet says the persistence and degradability of Noroa is not established. I sure wish I knew what that means. What's odd is effectiveness for the product, if you watch the videos, is said to be about 4.5 months. You put it in your hive, and it stops reproduction on the Varroa mites for about 4.5 months, and then you need to put more in. So at some point, it seems you have to refresh a colony environment, but that doesn't explain if it persists in the world. And this is a follow-up question to me when I wander into the booth. I want to review the instructions for application. That's where we go to next. The instructions say you place two of these pouches in a 10-frame box to treat the colony. If you're running two deeps, 20 frames, you put two more above the top bars of the upper box. And it should be noted that there was another treatment regime offered. The one I just described, they labeled as option one. And that's what they usually talk about. One deep, two packages. Two deeps, four packages. Two pouches in a 10-frame box. Two deeps, it's four pouches. Option two is to place one pouch per brood box. And then you follow that by a second pouch placed on the hive 1 to 3 weeks after the initial one. That's option two. To be more specific, you place the first pouch there during that 1 to 3 week window. And it seems that at any point after 1 week, you find the pouch is expended, you can remove the empty pouch and replace it with the second one. In the end, you're using two pouches for a single brood box. Still, it's just a different application process. An important point is, either way, option one or option two process, you will remove the empty packages and discard them when they're empty. And what's interesting is they don't tell you you could just throw these in the regular trash. I assume that to be the case, given what we talked about for the safety profile. But in full disclosure, I think I'll ask that question too. Now, one thing that has to be accounted for in the application of this product is the space required for the pouches to sit on the top bars. They're a little larger in size, and you can't just put a box over them. For illustrative purposes, consider what a large Ziploc bag would look like if you filled it with water and laid it down on the surface. You'd never be able to lay a box over that. You will need to place a spacer on your box to accommodate the extra room required for them to sit on the bars. Under the upper box or under the inner cover for the second deep. Isn't that interesting? It's like an Imry shim from what I saw for sale. They show you that on the Manlike website. With no notch, of course. Now, what I didn't find, what doesn't seem to be present in the instructions, another follow-up in the booth, is inquiring minds want to know, can you use it on a 5-frame nuke? Is it safe to assume that if you're running a nuke with 5 frames, you just use one bag? And what if you're running 3 mediums? It talks about deeps, but I don't recall seeing anything about mediums. The logical process would be you'd put it over the first box and then over the second box and put the third medium over top of those with shims between them. It doesn't say. Again, this all is the typical thing that comes out after the fact. It was the same with several other miticides. Elaboration on the instructions was passed on. I tried to see if there was any information over on the Honeybee Health Coalition, but given this product is so new, don't see anything there yet. Another line of thinking on this is, can I just use this? Is this all I need from now on? Actually, no. The instructions emphasize that this is not a one-and-done product to be used in isolation. Said in a different way, you can't use this product exclusively. They indicate you should rotate other products in, other miticides, to effectively kill the mites here and there and keep them at bay. This is meant to be a combination product, not a standalone as your sole treatment of choice. To further bolster the instructions, they emphasize that the application is best in early spring, before your supers are on, because remember, no honey supers, when the mite loads are low. And they infer that you should not use this as the sole treatment options with colonies that have high mite infestations. And here's an interesting wrinkle. You can use this with other products. Say you have a high mite load count in your colony. You could put Formic Pro for the knockdown and this product at the same time. Formic wipes out the broader population, and this product keeps the mite population at bay for the duration of its effectiveness. And what is that duration of effectiveness? It seems your mileage may vary, but general terms were offered of 18 weeks, or 4 to 4.5 months of effectiveness. And the suggested pattern was you could use this in the spring as soon as you can open hives. It stands to reason that as soon as you can give bees sugar solution, then you could put this product on your hives. So illustratively, let's say April 1st. April 1st, a short period of time after you put it on the 1st, the bees take up the product, distribute it. And when the product is empty, you could put your honey supers on. And if I understand it right, bees take this down in a matter of days. Running the path for the rest of April, May, June, and July, 4 months, you slow down the mite reproduction with the product present. And if it's 4.5 months, you could trickle into August. So in early to mid-August, you do whatever summer manipulations you're going to do. And after a short break, maybe you treat with something else. So you kill any of the varroa mites that didn't get taken out by Noroa. You could do it again. Take that short break. And then you do your treatment if you find something with another product. And when you have no honey supers on because you pulled your summer harvest, you could throw this in. Let's say you start September 1st or the middle of August. That would give you the middle of August, September, October, November, and forward. The 4.5 months would take you in December, and well, you might have done a significant interruption to the mites all the way through. And yes, along the way, you would measure and treat alternatively when warranted. Maybe your bees went out and robbed something in the middle of fall and the mite loads came up. You could throw another product in. Apigard, oxalic acid. Through the several methods that are available now. And mite loads, you know, or bee population, meaning rearing, is slowed down at the latter part of the year. What it says to me, what stands out to me is, as a beekeeper for 2026, you're going to really have to evaluate this. If you plan to use it, then you're going to have to plan the work and work the plan. Trying to figure out what your approach is going to be. Now, I know this is a lot. It's a lot to take in. This is where I'm going to pause and kind of come to a close. Are there more questions? Sure. We found many to ask, and I'm positive there'll be more on the horizon as beekeepers become familiar with the product. I realize I didn't talk about price. I didn't talk about pack sizes and other purchasing attributes. I'm going to say in a neutral kind of way, the cost and details are clearly visible on the Man Like website. And I don't want to talk about that now. If you see it as a high cost, well, let's just say I won't say that I'm surprised about that. And it's especially true if you have a lot of hives. This could really ring the bell for how much money you would spend. But this is the thing, the value for what it does has to be assessed. You can only determine if the cost nets the value for what you're getting by using it in your operation. And if it's saving beehives from having to be replaced and the work that goes along with that, maybe the cost justifies the value. Maybe the cost justifies the value. That's really a personal thing. Now, pouch administration, it's up to 3 weeks duration, but likely the bees, as I said earlier, are going to empty it far sooner. And you need to remove the pouches out of your product. How do you do that in December? Another question. Do you want to open your bees to do that? Is it harmful to leave them in there? I said there's questions and questions. I just wanted to illustrate that I had even more. What about storage? There is information on that. 2-year lifespan on the shelf. And given it's sugar water in a bag, you realize it could be impacted by temperature, so you'd have to store it following their instructions. One last thing to say about this product. It's U.S. made and distributed. A lot of these products come out of Europe, but this one is U.S. based. In the end, are we not in interesting times when it comes to our choices for varroa control if we are treatment style beekeepers? I was mentioning this to someone else. If I wanted to spend this year considering the different choices, trying them to make sure that I know how these products work by using them personally, I'd have to have a lot of hives. I'd have to have a lot of hives to treat in order to run all these in multiple places and make sure how they work. As it is, there's a bunch of links for this episode. You should visit the Naroa website directly, get information there. You should look at the research papers I cited, and I'm sure there's more out there. You should look at the safety data sheet, make your own assessment of that. There is, of course, the Manlake pages for Naroa. And if at all possible, you get to state or regional conferences and you see the representatives from Naroa standing in the booth, take your questions to them. They're the right people to ask about their product. It's their job to educate the public and the beekeepers on how to use the product properly, effectively, and also any of the harm profiles that are possibly out there. They should be spot on in answering any of the questions. They are the experts, along with, of course, the government reviewers. Naroa. Wow. This one is different, and it's going to take a while to understand. First in class, that's the way I'll describe it, what impact it will have on the beekeeping industry. 2026 is going to be really fun to watch. Hey, it's me. I just told you 2026 is going to be fun to watch. It struck me on recording the intro that if you made it this far, I owed you a little something. And so I'm going to take you back to my 1986 self. I was a young man. I used to work in a movie theater, a 5 cinema. Fun days back then because one of the things I could do now is quote multiple movies because you sat and watched them every day while you were working. And if you liked ones, you just parked yourself in the back of the theater. So what I'm about to share, that's the first tip, 1986. It goes a little something like this. And what's funny is, this is the other part of it, I used to stand in the back of the theater as people were exiting and kind of try to block them from leaving. Because they missed this part. It was at the end of the movie. And a lot of people got up and left and never got to see it. So it's a rather arcane thing. But let me give a shot at it. And then what I want you to do, Kevin at BKCorner.org, you write me and let me know if you know this. Or better yet, if you're attending the Midwest Expo and you listen to this, when you see me there, tell me what movie this is. Ready? You're still here? It's over. Go home. Go. Yeah. I'm such a goofball sometimes. Like our beloved bees with beekeepers. Go together. We can accomplish great things. Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll catch you on the next episode of the Beekeeper's Corner podcast.